Oh, sorry to hear that Andrew's leaving. I liked having someone to commiserate about the woes of being a student, the woes of going to school. He's been an inspiration to me while he's been here, and I'd be sorry to see him go. This is, I guess, a time of transition you must experience every year. My family and I are actually in the same boat. We're going to be moving in a few weeks. We're going to be in Florida. God has blessed us with a job down there at a school in Temple Terrace. And as excited as we are to start a new life somewhere else, it's going to be hard for us to leave the group here. My wife and I have often commented that this is the most loving group that we've ever been associated with. And we've been to a lot of congregations, and we've traveled around a lot. But we instantly felt welcomed here, and we've enjoyed every minute of it. And we'll need help moving. I'll let you know more details as it comes available. Okay, to get into the lesson, let's start by imagining a battlefield about 3,000 years ago or so. And on this battlefield are rank after rank of these men armed with a bow, regaled in armor, all ready for battle. You know, they take their bows and they synchronously fire their arrows into the air, and they have these fantastic shooting exhibitions, and everybody's very impressed, and the sunlight is glinting off of their armor. And as you walk on this field, you think, wow, these people are really prepared for battle. And this is kind of the idea that was here in Psalm 78. But there was one problem with this group of people. When it came time to go to war, each man turned away. They ran away from the battle. They didn't have the courage to stand before their enemies. Let's read Psalm 78 again, starting in verse 6 and going through 10. It says, that the generation to come might know, even the children yet to be born, that they may arise and tell them to their children, that they should put confidence in God and not forget the works of God, but keep his commandments, and not be like their fathers, a stubborn and rebellious generation. A generation that did not prepare its heart, and whose spirit was not faithful to God. The sons of Ephraim were archers, equipped with bows, yet they turned their back in the day of battle. They did not keep the covenant of God, and they refused to walk in his law. So this is a physical battle, but he's using it as an analogy of the fact that these people had turned away from God's will because of their cowardice. And there are a lot of applications to this passage, but I want to focus on just one, and one of the most important that we can draw from this, and that's, do we have the courage to meet our responsibility when it comes to leading and managing our families? And I didn't coordinate this with Brother Hayes this morning, but what he did in Peter is going to apply very strongly to the lesson this morning. We face strong opposition from the world. We are in a spiritual battle. We're engaged in spiritual warfare. Sometimes it doesn't seem like we are. But the stakes for this battle are far more serious than any kind of earthly battle. This world tells us that we need to be workaholics, that we need to make ourselves rich, that we must have two incomes to survive. It tells us that spanking our children is child abuse. It tells us that a keeper at home is worth nothing, in direct violation of the worthy woman in Proverbs 31. It tells us that the traditional family structure is worthless, it's artificial, it's an unnecessary construct that was designed thousands of years ago and it doesn't really apply anymore in our modern age. It tells us that they, that is the world, are better qualified to teach our children about ethics, about morality, about sexuality. And it's a world where spiritual leadership is a book about Scientology, or spouting junk about moral relativism. That's what goes for spirituality in our world today. So do we have the courage to stand up against this kind of opposition from the world and lead our families, manage our families, the way God designed? Now, begin with fathers, because this is a lesson for myself. We know most of our roles pretty well from our culture. There is still ingrained in our culture because of a lot of the reason that this is still in our culture is because of the fact that we have Judeo-Christian ethics just built into our society from times past. But we know that a father must toil or must work to provide for his family. And from the very beginning, this was true. This was true from the time of Adam. If you look over in Genesis chapter 3, starting in verse 17, this is when they're thrown out of the Garden of Eden. Verse 17 says, "Then to Adam he said, 'Because you have listened to the voice of your wife and have eaten from the tree which I commanded of you, saying, you shall not eat of it, cursed is the ground because of you. In toil you will eat of it all the days of your life. Both thorns and thistles it will grow for you, and you will eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your face you will eat bread, till you return to the ground. Because from it you were taken, for you are dust, and to dust you shall return.'" So this was the direction that man was to go in. Hard work. Now today our hard work may be more of the mind and less of the body, in some cases. But it's still, the principle is still very applicable. We need to be providers of our, for our families. 1 Timothy 5 in verse 8 talks about this when it says, "But if anyone does not provide for his own, and especially for his household, he is denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever." Now in the context it's talking about taking care of your parents. But the same principle applies. If you're not willing to take care of your own family, then you're worse than someone who has never obeyed the gospel in the first place. But this is not the extent of our responsibility. Providing for our families is a prerequisite. It's not the final responsibility. In fact, there's much, much more. I came across an article about George Washington. And being in this area, I've been really interested in the time period of the Revolutionary War and a lot of characters that were involved in that struggle. And one of the things I found about George Washington, he was considered to be probably the greatest leader that America has seen. Certainly one of the greatest leaders of the Revolutionary War. And some people even went to as far as to call him the father of our country. Now, the question is, why would he be such a strong leader? What about George Washington made him such a powerful leader in our minds today and the people who followed him? And I want to read something to you that kind of talks about this. This question that inevitably arises in the mind of anyone who studies, even on a casual basis, the founding of our nation. Washington lived and worked with brilliant philosophers, thinkers, writers, orators, and organizers such as Benjamin Franklin, George Mason, John and Samuel Adams, Jefferson, Patrick Henry, Hamilton, Madison, almost all of whom were far better educated than he. Yet at the three major junctions in the founding of the nation, the Revolution, the Constitutional Convention, and the selection of the first president, for each position, the leader chosen was George Washington. In his own day, he was seen as the indispensable man, the American Moses, the father of the country. Why? And he goes on to say, "Washington was chosen for these leadership roles because of his character and also because of his genius in the area of leadership. They trusted him because he had demonstrated a noble and incorruptible character, and he had also shown himself to be an exceptional leader." And he goes on to talk about all of the good leadership qualities that Washington had. And even though the writer here is talking about a military leader, just kind of make the transition in your mind. Think of it in terms of a father's spiritual leadership in the home and see some of the parallels that are here, and then we'll bring it back to the Word of God after that. This article I was reading said, "The visionary leader, first of all, has a very clear, encompassing, and far-reaching vision with regard to the cause or organization involved. This vision includes ideas and goals which remain constant, no matter how long it takes to realize them and regardless of what difficulties that leader encounters. Furthermore, the leader never allows any of the means or actions along the way to violate or invalidate this mission and its constituent values." So that's kind of wordy, but this is a person who has a vision that doesn't change. This is a person that decides what he wants for his household and steers his household towards that direction. And if he has problems along the way, he overcomes those problems and continues with his vision. Most importantly, he doesn't allow any kind of means toward those ends to violate the values of his vision. Secondly, the visionary leader is a skillful person that designs and creates an organizational culture which makes it possible for the attainment of the leader's visions and ideas. He controls the atmosphere in the family to make it possible for these goals to be met. Thirdly, he says, the visionary leader is also the person who can attract others to follow him and seeking the attainment of this vision. But more than that, this charismatic person is able to instill this idea in others. In brief, the visionary leader plans into the far future. He can develop an effective organization. He can attract others to strive for the attainment of his vision so that it becomes a shared vision. And all those in the family work together in an organization that sustains its beliefs and values. All right, so this, a lot of this sounds like something I read in one of my leadership textbooks from school. But I believe that this person is writing about George Washington makes some good points. George Washington was remarkable in his ability to lead. And I'm going to read two examples of things that he has done it's not so wordy. It's something that we can kind of grasp because it's an example of what all leaders need to do, especially spiritual leaders in the home. In 1776, Christmas Day, the battle at Trenton, New Jersey, after crossing the Delaware, many of the soldiers were ready to leave because their enlistments were up. Washington urgently appealed to them to step forward and stay with him in this noble cause. Hesitantly at first, but then almost completely, the soldiers stepped forward because of their trust in and their regard for Washington. In that moment, he saved the army and the revolutionary cause. So why was Washington a good leader? One of the reasons was that he was then able to instill courage in other people. He was able to instill this, even when people were dropping out of battle, like the sons of Ephraim, when they were turning and running the other direction, and the battle looked to be lost, he was able to charge in and continue, make these people stay with the cause. Now, trust that these men had for General Washington, it's not something that you can command. It's not something that you can force. We talked this morning about subjection. Subjection is not something the husband does to the wife. It's something the wife does of her own accord for the husband. So sometimes I think a young man mistake is to think that trust is not important, that leadership comes by laying down the law and insisting that this be the way it is. Trust is something that's earned over time. And using trust, Washington was able to save his army even before it disintegrated. Do we watch our families disintegrate before our eyes? When we're about to lose our children in the world, do we have any pull over them? Do we have any control over what they do and what they think? Do they trust us? Do they look at our good example? Do they see our loyalty to our family? Do they see that we have a commitment to God? Or do they look at us and say, you're a joke. You say one thing and you do another. You've never been somebody that I can look to as an example in this area, so I don't need it. I don't need God. I don't need to become a Christian. Another example from Washington is the Battle of Monmouth, New Jersey, all these battles in New Jersey. In 1778, this revealed his charismatic leadership and his genius as a battlefield tactician. In this crucial battle with Cornwall's army, the American troops were in retreat and disarray when Washington took personal control. Lafayette said that his presence, this is a quote, his presence stopped the retreat. And Hamilton also wrote, other officers have great merit in performing their parts well, but he directed the whole with the skill of a master workman. I never saw the general to so much advantage. And the British retreated to New York. So one of the things that made Washington a good leader is that he was there. He wasn't someone that was off on a distant hilltop somewhere, making plans and directing from a distance. He was someone that charged into battle with his troops. He was beside them for all of their challenges. Now, it's important to note that he did delegate responsibility, but he took full responsibility himself. And he didn't guide just through rhetoric, he guided through action. He guided by example. The minimum requirement for a husband to be the head of his household and to lead his family is that he be present, that he be there to be a good leader and a strong leader. You can't do it from a distance. We can't just swoop in, see our children for a few minutes, give them a few words of wisdom and pat them on the head and leave and think that we're being a spiritual leader of our home. There was a team of researchers that wanted to find out how much time middle class fathers spent with their children, playing and interacting with them. And they asked a group of fathers just to give an estimate of how long they spent with these one-year-old children each day. And they received a reply of an average of 15 or 20 minutes. That was just their ballpark estimation. And so what they did is they put microphones on their shirts and they tried to verify this experimentally to find out how long these middle-class fathers were spending with their one-year-old children, actually engaging with them. And they found that it was 37 seconds a day on average. The average encounter was 2.7 encounters daily lasting 10 to 15 seconds each. So a spiritual leader cannot have this kind of brief, tangential relationship with their kids and expect their kids not to fall away when they get older. 54% of 4 through 6-year-old children in America would rather watch TV than spend time with their fathers. 54%. My daughter's 6 years old. That's a terrifying statistic. So, like a general, we have this oppositional force that's telling us to retreat. It's making us more and more busy because we're trying to get more material wealth or whatever the worldly goals happen to be in our generation. They're threatening to defeat us and defeat our families with materialism, with sexual immorality, drug abuse, alcoholism, with humanism, atheism, and a love of the world. Fathers, do not provoke your children to anger, but bring them up in the nurture and admonition, or the discipline and the instruction of the Lord. This passage mentions fathers for a reason. This is our responsibility primarily. We're the ones that hold the buck stops here kind of idea. We're the ones who are ultimately responsible for the direction that our family moves in. So, we can delegate responsibility, but it's not the same as taking responsibility ourselves. And I could go back to George Washington again, but I think it's time we look in the Word of God. 1 Timothy 3. 1 Timothy 3, starting in verse 4. This is talking about the qualifications of an elder. He must be one who manages his own household well, keeping his children under control with all dignity. But if a man does not know how to manage his own household, how will he take care of the church of God? This isn't a lesson on the qualities or the qualifications of an elder. In fact, we're looking at this from a standpoint of all men who are trying to be the spiritual leader of their homes. And all of us should be trying to develop the qualities that an elder has. I mean, they're kind of put as the ideal, apart from Jesus, they're put as the ideal of what young men are to strive to be. And so all of us should be trying to attain these kind of same qualities. And we need to be responsible and manage our own household well, keeping our children under control with all dignity. This is a primary function of the father, not the mother. So we can delegate responsibility, but as long as we realize that we're ultimately responsible. There's no substitute for our literal presence in the home. Now, going on to mothers, we talked about this morning as well. What is the responsibility of a mother? Sometimes mothers' roles are considered to be a secondary role to the father. But they're not. They're complementary. They're integral. You have to have both of them to have a functioning family. Now, what has happened in our society is there's been a shift where the role of a mother, and I think it may be modern technology, I'm not sure what to attribute it to, maybe the Industrial Revolution, World War II, I mean, there are a lot of theories. But the role of a woman in taking care and managing the household has shifted to the workplace. And so now we have two fathers. We have two people that go out and they're wage earners, and the home is neglected. Titus 2, verses 4 through 5, gives us an example. The aged woman likewise must be in behavior as becometh holiness, not false accusers, not given to much wine, teachers of good things, that they may teach the young women, to be sober, to love their husbands, to love their children, to be discreet, chaste, keepers at home, good, obedient to their own husbands, that the word of God not be blasphemed. What does this term, keeper at home, mean? Well, some people misinterpret it as a stayer at home, but in fact, that isn't what it means at all. A keeper at home is a very, very broad concept. And it often involves a woman working and functioning outside the home, as we can see from Proverbs 31. She's planting vineyards, she's buying land, she's securing the domestic responsibilities. Proverbs 31, let's go over there and take the time to read this. Let's start in verse 10. Who may make discovery of a woman of virtue, for her price is much higher than jewels? The heart of her husband has faith in her, and he will have profit in full measure. She does good to him, and not evil, all the days of her life. She gets wool and linen, working at the business of her hands. She is like the trading ships getting food from far away. She gets up while it is still night, and gives meat to her family, and their food to the servant and food to the servant girls. After looking at a field, with care she gets it for a price, planting a vineyard with the profit of her work. She puts a band of strength around her and makes her arms strong. She sees that her marketing is of profit to her, and her light does not go out by night. She puts her hand on the cloth working rod, and her fingers take the wheel. Her hands are stretched out to the poor, yes, she is open-handed to those who are in need. She has no fear of the snow for her family, for all those in her house are clothed in red. She makes for herself cushions of needlework. Her clothing is fair linen and purple. Her husband is a man of notes in the public place, when he takes his seat among the responsible men of the land. She makes linen robes and gets them for a price. Gets a price for them. And traders take her clothes for a price. Strength and self-respect are her clothing. She is facing the future with a smile. Her mouth is open to give out wisdom, and the law of mercy is on her tongue. She gives attention to the ways of her family. She does not take her food without working for it. Her children get up and give her honor, and her husband gives her praise, saying, "Unnumbered women have done well, but you are better than them all. Fair looks are a deceit, and a beautiful form is of no value. But a woman who has the fear of the Lord is to be praised. Give her credit for what her hands have made. Let her be praised by her works in the public place." I know I used a strange translation there, but I wanted to be really clear. What we're talking about here, when we talk about the ideal for a woman, this is a person that works hard. She's creative and productive. She has control over resources. She has money at her disposal. She's generous with the people of the community. She has the means to bring income into the family, or she has some means of building resources that help the family. She has ingenuity. She has business savvy. She's a good manager of others. She exalts and supports her husband. She manages her home. She takes care of making sure that everyone has proper clothing, the house has furniture that is required, that everyone has the food they need to eat. She makes sure that we have enough money to get through the year. She makes sure everyone's healthy and strong and everyone has their medicine. And the Bible says in Proverbs 31 that she maketh her arms strong. Have you ever seen that World War II poster? It says, "We can do it," as a woman with a big, strong bicep. That's kind of the idea here. It's not necessarily going to work in the factories, but it's something that implies hard work, diligence, creativity. It's not someone who sits on the sofa and watches television during the day, which is how our society wants to frame it. So keeping a home entails a lot. The keeper at home is a broad concept, and a woman who stays at home might even never dream of becoming a keeper. So it's good to keep those two things separate in our minds. But there's more. Women have even more responsibility than that. They have to be involved in raising children the same way fathers are involved in raising children. But mothers tend to be with their children more often. So their responsibility, even though fathers are ultimately responsible, they have more day-to-day contact and therefore have the most influence. Proverbs 22 in verse 6 says, "Train up a child in the way he will go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it." We've read this passage, and sometimes we're quick to say that it's not talking in absolutes here. That you can raise a child and do everything right, and they can turn out wrong. While I have no doubt that that's probably true on average, I think that, just look at the Amish. Look at Islam. They keep their children generation after generation after generation. How do they do that? Well, it's not magic. They talk about their religion to their children constantly. It's on their mouth every day. The Bible will be read in our home regularly. This isn't something that we do on Sunday. This is something we do constantly in our homes. Otherwise, we will lose our children. And if we have the faith in this passage, we can raise our children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord, and when they're old, they will still be Christians, and they'll still be faithful to God. And we can not maybe trust conventional wisdom, and maybe put more of our trust in what the Bible actually says. The world would call it brainwashing. They would say, "Oh, you guys are a cult. You brainwash your kids." Well, you know, when the kid is old enough, they make their own decisions. But when they're young, you know, we don't give them free rein. We have to curtail their activities, structure their lives, and when they're old, they won't depart from it. So we need to defend having influence on our children when we're young. The fact is that a lot of liberal groups have mobilized to defend your children from you. They want to take you and your influence out of the picture. This is especially true in New England, particularly in the Boston area. If you look at being involved with the schools around here, I can see some of the curriculum is designed to take that influence away from parents and to put it more in the hands of teachers who basically want to change the way children think. The homosexual movement in the United States has basically given up on us older people, as hopeless. You know, we're not going to change our minds. So the next battleground is the schools with children. And they're after our kids. They're going to change the way that they think. They're going to have them accept alternative lifestyles, family structures that are not authorized by God, and they're countermanding the morality that you're trying to teach your children at home. I think of an example even from the 1970s with my own wife when she was a young girl. Her parents had told her she wasn't allowed to go to a school dance, and her teacher brought her aside, and I guess it was junior high, brought her aside and said, "No, your parents told you that this is wrong, but actually they're wrong, and when you're older, you'll realize that this is just a silly rule that they made for you. You know, and I hope you can just kind of remember this when you're older, that your parents don't always make the proper decisions for you." And she did this real hush-hush. And I think that even that kind of overt countermanding of authority absolutely happens in public schools. So be on your guard. Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. There are a lot of other influences in the world, but a mother who's acting under the umbrella of the spiritual leadership of the father can't go wrong. There was a graduate student in one of the Ivy League schools up in this area that was expelled because of a paper that he wrote about corporal punishment, about spanking. And they kicked him out. And they didn't refund his tuition. And they said that the reason they kicked him out was his views were incompatible with the philosophy of the school. So don't be fooled, both of you are students, that you have freedom of speech, because you don't. Freedom of speech in higher education is a myth. What they really mean is that any liberal cause is fine. You're allowed to burn the flag. You can burn an effigy of the president. You can put a cross in a urinal and you can call it art. You can teach elementary school kids to explore their sexuality without inhibitions, but don't even dare to imply that there's an absolute standard for right and wrong, or that kids shouldn't be disobedient or should be spanked when they are. A lot of our kids, we wouldn't lose them if we just take the opportunity to spank them. And discipline, we know from the Bible, is a mark of true love. Proverbs 13, verse 24 says, "He who withholds the rod hates his son." Strong language there. "But he who loves him will discipline him diligently." This is saying you hate your child if you don't spank them. You realize that? You hate your son if you don't spank them. But he who loves him diligently disciplines him. So the Bible is our standard, not liberal society or education experts or psychologists. Too many will despair at his crying and say, "Oh, well, this doesn't feel right. I can't spank my kid." Proverbs 19, verse 18 says, "Discipline your son while there is yet hope." And Proverbs 29, verse 15 says, "The rod of reproof gives wisdom, but a child who gets his own way brings shame to his mother." Why bring shame to his mother and not the father? This passage implies that mothers have a key responsibility for not indulging their children and for disciplining them. And it also says that children are taught wisdom when they're young. They're not taught it when they're 16, 17, 18. We're not done when they're that old, but they're taught wisdom when they're young. That's the time that it's crucial to discipline your children. You can't put an 18-year-old over your knee, at least not very easily. Although my father still spanked me when I was 17, I'm embarrassed to admit. He did that one time, and I threatened to leave home when he didn't do it. By the time they're 17, if you don't have any control over them, it's too late. Our choices are important. What we decide to do will affect generations to come. That is the biggest tree I've ever seen. And I picked this because of some research that I've been doing, this visual, about my own family. There was a man named Johannes Gingrich, that was born in 1695 in Bern, Switzerland. And he got married when he was 17 years old to Magdalena Erb. And they were basically, they had to come to the United States. They had to immigrate to the United States because of religious persecution. This was a time when Anabaptists, is what they called them, that means rebaptized. Basically, these were people who decided that sprinkling wasn't really baptism. And so they started baptizing people, and they called them rebaptizers or Anabaptists. And the Protestants and the Catholics both were attacking them and killing them in large numbers. So these people, this young couple, came to the United States, immigrated to Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and had six children. And 310 years later, they have thousands of descendants. One of which is my daughter who's sleeping right here. Now, when they were a 17-year-old couple, do you think that they knew that their influence would extend to thousands of people in the new world, and that it would include even myself and my own family? It's unbelievable how quickly our influence can travel. We have people in this group that have multiple grandchildren. And in just three or four generations, you have dozens of people who are influenced by the decisions that you make. So these aren't isolated incidents. These aren't disciplining your child, raising your children in nurture and admonition of the Lord, being a keeper at home, being a spiritual leader of your home. This is going to affect more people than just you and your own children. So the question is, do we have our equipment? We have our bow, we have our armor. We're prepared. We know what the Word of God says. But when we start to face the enemy, when they're marching across the battlefield in this liberal society that we live in, do we turn tail and run? Or do we insist on holding to what some people view as old-fashioned ideals? You know, I hate to talk about politics because it's irrelevant to Christianity, but one of the things the Republican Party always stood for and talked about was family values, and now that's ridiculed. Have you ever seen the bumper sticker that says, "Hatred is not a family value"? I always want to put a little addendum to that saying, Republicans agree, hatred is not a family value. but the idea is that family values are not considered to be their passé. It's an old-fashioned idea that doesn't have any place in our own society anymore. But we need to stand against that, because our decisions will affect those who are yet to be born. And I want to conclude by reading Psalm 78, verses 6 through 10. That the generation to come might know, even the children yet to be born, that they may arise and tell them to their children, that they should put their confidence in God, and not forget the works of God, but keep his commandments, and not be like their fathers, a stubborn and rebellious generation, a generation that did not prepare its heart, and whose spirit was not faithful to God. The sons of Ephraim were archers, equipped with bows, yet they turned their back in the day of battle. They did not keep the covenant of God and refused to walk in his law. If you're not a Christian, there's a possibility that you could raise very successful children. They could be very well socially adjusted. They could have good jobs. But if you're not a Christian, they will probably not be a Christian either. And neither will their children. And it goes on generation after generation. One of the things you can do for your posterity and for your own soul is to realize that true wisdom comes from God. And the only way to gain a relationship with God is through baptism and obedience. And we have that opportunity this morning. If you're not a Christian, we have the means to baptize you here behind me. This is something that every Christian here has done. It doesn't make a person better because they're baptized, but it does make them saved because of the blood of Christ. So if you find yourself in a situation where you're raising a family or you're planning to raise a family and you're not a Christian, realize that you're at a distinct disadvantage right off the bat. 50% of marriages end in divorce. One of the reasons for this is because people don't trust in God. They don't trust in God's pattern for the family. The happiest families tend to be those who not only are Christians, but actually live as Christians and follow after the patterns that we have. If you are a Christian and you haven't been faithful, we also offer this invitation to you as we stand and sing the song that's been announced.